Hello, welcome to Medium Cool, a movie podcast. I'm your host, Austin Glidden, and as always, you can find us on social media by searching Medium Cool Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, aka X. Or you can email us at mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'm really hyped about this week. I'm going to do some more housekeeping like I did last week. And the first thing I want to say is I've been watching a lot of movies lately, okay? And one of which is the Mike Nichols 1967 film The Graduate, which I hope to talk about soon because it made me want to cover the new Hollywood movement even more. And that's not to mention the motivation I have, you know, due to being on this Schrader kick and him kind of growing up into the new Hollywood movement anyways. And so to clarify, last week, of course, we did the introduction to Schrader. This week and next week, I'll be covering a film apiece. This week, I'm doing Hardcore, and I will talk more about what I'm going to do next week in the outro. And then, next week, I will either have bonus content to accompany that main episode, or depending on how much time I've been able to put into the new Hollywood movement, I may have the following. So 2 weeks from now, I may have the uncut episode of Matthew Soucy and I talking about Schrader's Hardcore, Cat People, Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, and Light Sleeper. So I will keep you all posted on that. I'll have probably more of an update on that in the schedule next week for housekeeping, I hope. But obviously, I will be using some of the content that I talked about with Matthew Soucy for the two films we're going to cover, the one today and the one next week. So I will come back to that here shortly. Now, like I mentioned last week, I'm not planning on doing very many kind of like ratings type things. If you want to see my ratings for movies, you are more than welcome to go follow me on Letterboxd. You can also follow Medium Cool Pod, the podcast, Medium Cool Pod on Letterboxd. I have the links in the show description. Wherever you're listening to this, it should be there. But for the show, when I'm talking, I felt like doing kind of a tier system. Instead of talking about movies being like, well, it's a 3 out of 5. And then, you know, someone being like, oh, 3's bad. But like for me, a 3 is still in the positive. You know, so even though that's what, 60% or something, I know that's like a D if we were talking about letter grade. So the point is it gets really convoluted. So the 5-tier system, by the end, you know, we'll end up putting Hardcore in one of these categories. Tier 1 being the Medium Cool Pantheon. So the Pantheon is the God tier. That is the number one top. Awesome. Tier 2 is the Hall of Excellence. So this is everything that didn't make it into the Pantheon going down to just some really kick-ass movies. Really good. Strong recommendations. I love these movies. And then Tier 3 is Watchable Wonders. So this would be your 3-star, you know what I mean? Or up to maybe 4, right? So somewhere in that, like, neutral, but I still like it to, like, overall positive. And then forgettable flicks is anything in the negative category. These are just like movies I think are forgettable or they're bad. And then bottom of the barrel is the worst of the worst. These are movies I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. Okay. Like I hate them a lot. And luckily there are not a lot in there currently. So I don't usually cover a lot of the ones I hate that much on the show. So that'd be fun. Definitely check that out. Those lists will be housed on the Medium Cool, a Movie Podcast Letterboxd page. Again, that is in the show description. You can follow us on there. You can also follow me on my personal account to get more frequent updates because I won't be updating the Medium Cool Letterboxd as much. That's just going to be where I house and kind of archive certain things, hopefully. But for frequent updates, you can follow me. And all accounts, again, linked in the show description. Now, all of that said, today I will be talking about Schrader's Hardcore from 1979. We'll look at the history, call back to last week's episode where we gave you a bunch of context about Schrader, look at the production process, the critical reception, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we'll dig in film history style, and then we'll bring Matthew Soucy in, and he and I will chat about the film together. So please, please stay tuned. Again, if you learn anything from this episode, or, you know, you're just really into the format or whatever, please hit us up on social media, Medium Cool Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, aka X, or email us at mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. I really want to hear your feedback sincerely. So for now, let's dig into Paul Schrader's 1979 directorial sophomore effort, Hardcore.
A controversial subject. A brilliant actor. A powerful and touching film. A movie which will take you into a world never dealt with in a major motion picture. A father searches for his missing daughter, only to find she has been used in a sordid and shocking way. Nothing you have ever done, seen, or imagined can prepare you for the experience of hardcore.
Turn it off!
George C. Scott, Hardcore.
Hardcore is a film that follows a conservative, deeply religious Midwestern businessman, Jake Van Dorn, whose daughter disappears during a church trip. When Jake discovers that his daughter has become involved in the porno film industry, he embarks on a desperate and dangerous journey through the underbelly of Los Angeles to find and rescue her. The film explores themes of morality, exploitation, and the clash between conservative values and the darker aspects of American culture. The film was also nominated for some international awards and was nominated for Worst Picture, Worst Supporting Actress, and Worst Actor at the Stinkers Bad Movie Awards, something I only mention because of how absolutely and utterly ludicrous this is. You'll learn about how I feel personally, about George C. Scott and the film overall later when I talk with Matthew Soucy. But all I'll say now is the film was not a major commercial success, but it has since gained a cult following for its daring subject matter and the intense performance by Scott. And in 1979, some sources say that the film had a budget of around $5 million and grossed $17 million, though I couldn't actually confirm any of this through sources like Box Office Mojo or anything where I couldn't find the information. But based on the, we'll call it hearsay that I've found, it cost about $5 million. It grossed about $17 million, which is a success. But following 70s blockbusters like Jaws, Star Wars, Close Encounters of a Third Kind, which Hardcore never had a chance of being, let's be clear, I'm not trying to compare them, but in a film industry that is now starting to move toward these moneymakers, this just was not a major release. So with that in mind, let's go ahead and look at some history, shall we? Paul Schrader is known for his exploration of dark and often controversial themes. This is no surprise. But when he wrote Hardcore, he wrote it as a way to delve into his own conservative Calvinist upbringing and to explore the contradictions and moral dilemmas associated with it. So the film was inspired by Schrader's own life experiences, particularly the conflict between his strict religious background and the more liberal secular world he encountered as he grew older. Now, as I said, Hardcore emerged from Paul Schrader's deeply personal reflections on his upbringing in the strict Calvinist family. Schrader's fascination with exploring themes of guilt and redemption and moral conflict, et cetera, is evident throughout his body of work, and Hardcore is absolutely no exception. Schrader has often spoken about how his Calvinist background influenced his worldview, particularly the concept of total depravity, which I mentioned last episode. It's the idea that every human being is inherently sinful and corrupt, in short. So, this belief, central to Calvinist doctrine, became a thematic cornerstone in Hardcore. So the film was inspired by Schrader's own experiences of moving from a conservative religious environment to the more liberal secular world of Hollywood. And Schrader's internal conflict between his religious upbringing and the permissive culture he found himself in led to, create characters like Jake Van Dorn, for example. And Jake Van Dorn embodies this struggle. The film was, in a way, Schrader's attempt to reconcile these opposing forces within himself. And all of this leads to the development of the project, which takes us further down this road. Schrader initially developed hardcore as a natural progression from his work on films like Taxi Driver from 1976, which he wrote for director Martin Scorsese. Now, both films feature protagonists who descend into a morally corrupt world in search of something or someone they've lost, reflecting Schrader's ongoing exploration of alienation and moral decay. Now, the idea for hardcore began to take shape as Schrader considered how a man from a devoutly religious background would react when confronted with the darker aspects of the world, particularly the burgeoning pornography industry in the 1970s. Now, Schrader's early drafts of the script were intense and unflinching, capturing the stark contrast between the conservative values of the protagonist and the depravity he encounters. The script was an extension of the theme Schrader had explored in Taxi Driver, but with a more direct focus on the conflict between religious morality and the secular world. Schrader's decision to set the film within the porn industry was both a commentary on the cultural changes of the time and a way to challenge the audience's perceptions of right and wrong. So this process of creation for Schrader was not only tapping into something that he had done before, like with Taxi Driver, but diving further into personal aspects of his artistic interests. So Schrader begins his journey to give the film some legs. And whose legs does he get? George C. Scott. Schrader begins working on casting and crew recruitment, and where else could we start but with George C. Scott? One of the critical elements in bringing hardcore to life was the casting of Scott as the lead actor Jake Van Dorn. And at the time, Scott was a highly respected actor, known for his powerful performances in films such as Patton in 1970 and Dr. Strangelove in 1964. And Schrader recognized that the success of hardcore would hinge on finding an actor who could convincingly portray the intense emotional and psychological turmoil of a father whose daughter has been drawn into the porn industry. So it's important to understand that George C. Scott was one of the most respected and formidable actors in American cinema. Okay, so when we talk about this, we're not talking about some, you know, gross old dude, okay? We're talking about like a well-respected actor, and he was known for his intense performances, commanding presence, and an uncompromising approach to his craft. But by the time that Hardcore was released in 1979, Scott had already established himself as a major force in the entertainment industry with a career that spanned theater, television, and film. And I want to dig in to George C. Scott's history a little bit here. George C. Scott began his acting career on the stage, where he quickly made a name for himself with his powerful and magnetic performances. His work in the theater in the 1950s, particularly his productions like Richard III in The Merchant of Venice, earned him critical acclaim and laid the foundation for his later success in film and television. Now, Scott's transition to film in the late 1950s was marked by a series of strong supporting roles that showcased his remarkable range and intensity. He gained early recognition for his performance as the aggressive and unyielding prosecutor Claude Dancer in Anatomy of a Murder from 1959, directed by Otto Preminger, a great movie for the record, and this role earned him his first Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor, signaling his arrival as a significant talent in Hollywood. The 1960s were a defining decade for Scott, during which he solidified his reputation as one of the finest actors of his generation. His portrayal as General Buck Turgidson in Stanley Kubrick's, I love Stanley Kubrick, as we all know, my very favorite, but in Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb in 1964, became one of the most iconic roles in the film and one of his overall. The film, a dark satire of Cold War politics, of course, featured Scott as a bombastic and gung-ho military leader, a performance that was both hilarious and chilling in his depiction of the absurdity of war. His work in Dr. Strangelove earned him another Academy Award nomination, further cementing his status as a top-tier actor. Now, let me do a quick caveat here. Obviously, I've talked many times on the podcast about how I think the Academy Awards are all politics and just very little merit, and they're fucking stupid. But let me tell you where their merit lies, though. Their merit lies in the ability of a, or the willingness, rather, of a studio to push an actor. Okay, so the average American, you know, the casual moviegoer, so to speak, is going to look and go, oh shit, the Academy Awards is the biggest American award ceremony that we have. And this dude just won. He's top cheese here. You know what I mean? So it has optics. All right. The Oscars, the reason I'm even bringing them up and stuff is because of the optics. And so it's very interesting and very important that he was nominated for these awards. However, it was his portrayal of General George S. Patton in the biopic war film Patton from 1970 that truly made George C. Scott a household name. Patton was a monumental success, and Scott's performance as the complex and controversial military leader was heralded as nothing short of extraordinary. He brought to life Patton's larger-than-life personas, brilliance as a strategist, and his deeply flawed personality attributes as a man. Scott's portrayal was so compelling that it earned him the Academy Award for Best Actor. This was his first and only Oscar win. Notably, Scott made history by refusing to accept that Oscar, actually, citing his disdain for the competitive nature of the awards and the perceived politics of the process. This decision only added to his mystique and reputation as an actor who was fiercely independent and committed to his principles. By the time Hardcore came along in 1979, George C. Scott was already an established veteran in Hollywood, known for his exceptional talent and his willingness to tackle, you know, challenging and often controversial roles. And his refusal to play by the rules of Hollywood, combined with his intense method of acting, made him a formidable presence both on and off the screen. So in the 1970s, Scott continued to deliver memorable performances in a variety of genres. He starred in films like The Hospital from 1971, for which he received yet another Academy Award nomination, and The Day of the Dolphin in 1973, demonstrating his versatility as an actor. Despite his success, Scott remained somewhat enigmatic, often shunning the limelight and maintaining a private, almost reclusive lifestyle. So going into Hardcore, Scott was at a point in his career where he had nothing to prove, but he still chose roles that challenged him and pushed the boundaries of his craft. Rather, his decision to take on the role of Jake Van Dorn in Hardcore was a testament to his willingness to explore complex, morally ambiguous characters. So Schrader's film offered Scott the opportunity to delve into the psyche of a deeply religious man who's forced to confront the darkest aspects of the world in a desperate search for his daughter. The role demanded a balance of emotional vulnerability and unwavering determination, qualities that Scott had mastered over his decades-long career. So it's easy to understand why this was a big deal for Schrader. Scott's involvement in Hardcore brought a level of gravitas to the film that few other actors could have provided. And his portrayal of Jack Van Dorn was marked by a deep intensity that mirrored the inner turmoil of a father whose entire moral framework is shattered. So Scott's ability to convey the character's internal conflict, his anger, fear, and desperation, added a profound layer of complexity to the film. And in Hardcore, Scott's performance is central to the film's exploration of such themes as faith and morality and the limits of human endurance. His portrayal of Van Dorn, a man who must navigate a world that is entirely alien to him, resonates with the audience. It makes the character's journey both compelling and heartbreaking, and Scott's ability to embody such a complex character with nuance and authority was a significant factor in the film's emotional impact. So we have an actor, but how in the hell is Schrader going to get this movie of all movies that he could do? How's he going to get Hardcore made? Well, by collaborating with A-Team Productions is how. While this is not his first collaboration with the company, the relationship was crucial to providing the resources and support needed to tackle such a controversial and ambitious project. So Schrader's previous work, including his screenwriting for Taxi Driver, had established him as a filmmaker who could handle difficult and provocative subject matter. And this reputation helped to secure the backing of A-Team Productions, even though the film's explicit content and moral ambiguity posed challenges in terms of marketing and distribution. But A-Team Productions was known for taking risks on projects that other studios might shy away from, to take on bold and controversial projects, and this provided the necessary resources and creative freedom that Schrader required to explore the deeply personal and provocative themes in Hardcore. So, who was the basket that Schrader was tossing his eggs in? A-Team Productions was an independent film production company with a reputation for embracing those projects deemed too risky or unconventional, as I mentioned before. And during a time when Hollywood was dominated by more mainstream commercial fare, thanks to Jaws and Star Wars and Close Encounters of a Third Kind, etc., A-Team stood out for its commitment to supporting films that pushed boundaries, whether in terms of content, style, or subject matter. This made them an ideal partner for filmmakers like Schrader, who were eager to explore darker and more complex narratives that might not have found a home at a traditional studio, we'll say. So, as I mentioned a moment ago, by the time Schrader began to work on Hardcore, he'd already made a significant impact on the film industry with his screenplay for Taxi Driver. And I can't stress enough the importance of Taxi Driver here, not only on cinema and culture at the time, but on Schrader. This is why I keep bringing it up, not just because it's one of my favorite films, but I digress. So Taxi Driver was a landmark film that delved into the psyche of an alienated, disturbed man living on the fringes of society. The film's success and critical acclaim established Schrader as a writer who was unafraid to tackle challenging and controversial topics. And it also established Schrader as a man who could craft narratives that resonate with audiences on a deep and emotional level. And I cannot wait to tackle Taxi Driver on an episode in the future. I think that will be really great. And there's so much to say about that film. And I guarantee you it's not the last time I'm going to bring it up in this episode. But the reputation that Schrader had built, you know, was instrumental in securing the backing of A-Team Productions for Hardcore. And the company recognized that Schrader had a unique voice and a proven ability to engage with difficult material in a way that was both thought-provoking and commercially viable. So despite the film's explicit content and morally ambiguous storyline, A-Team Productions was confident in Schrader's vision and his ability to deliver a film that would be both artistically significant and commercially successful. So the collaboration between Schrader and A-Team Productions was characterized by a high degree of creative autonomy, which was crucial for a project like Hardcore, and the film's narrative required a delicate balance and sensitivity and unflinching honesty, and that's something that Schrader can certainly offer in spades, is unflinching honesty, and it's here on display. So Schrader needed the freedom to explore these themes without the constraints that a more conventional studio might impose, particularly regarding censorship or the need to appeal to a broader audience. And like I mentioned during the last episode, you know, by this point in 1979, we're actually only technically 11 years away from essentially pure censorship. Granted, I know that had died off a few years prior, but with the production code, which I mentioned last episode, and we'd had a bunch of crazy shit come out in that 11 years, and I would go as far as to say 13 or 14 years, really. But really, we'll just throw it up to 15 years, okay? In 15 years, he gets here, and it's still a concern. right? The idea of censorship and the idea of people trying to self-censor and theaters not wanting to take certain things, et cetera, et cetera. This is still a concern in 1978, 1979. So 18 Productions, their willingness to embrace Schrader's vision meant that he could approach the material with the intensity and authenticity that the story demanded. And the company provided not only financial backing, but also the supportive environment where Schrader could push the boundaries of the medium and address the moral and spiritual dilemmas that were central to the film. So while 18 Productions was committed to the project, the explicit nature of hardcore and its exploration of taboo subjects posed significant challenges, really. It was a difficult time in terms of marketing and distribution. So the film's depiction of the pornography industry and its critique of conservative religious values made it a difficult sell to mainstream audiences and theater chains, kind of like what I was mentioning before. I just said that weird, theater chains. But anyways, 18 Productions' experience, however, with controversial films meant that they were prepared to navigate these obstacles. And I want to take a second to call back to last week's episode where I talked about beliefs, attitudes, and values. And this is super important because a lot of us might watch a movie like this and go, man, people back then were such prudes. What the hell? You know, or, you know, they were just whining, like, let people watch what they want. That's the whole point of the rating system. If you don't like it, don't watch it or whatever. You know, like we could talk about like the taboo subjects being raised here. We could talk about the culture and community and blah, 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 blah. But the whole point is this. Beliefs, attitudes, and values dictate how we think, feel, and behave, right? And so whenever we, take this for example, and I'm not going to go on too long of a tangent here, but take this for example. If you are a traditionalist Christian here, okay, and you believe that if someone dies, their spirit is going to be removed from their body, and if they are of sin, like they would think the people making this film and in this film, like all the things related to this film would probably be tied into this from people coming from this belief system. If these folks believe that people with sin are going to burn alive for all of eternity in this place called hell, right? If this is what they believe sincerely, I mean, not just like they say it, but I mean, they believe this. Why wouldn't people be fighting to save your life, to save your soul, to save your eternal life, as one might say, right? So thinking of beliefs, attitudes, and values helps us also understand others and their perspectives, especially those we don't agree with. So think of politics or anything else. You know, the idea of beliefs, attitudes, and values goes far beyond film or any kind of media or entertainment. But whenever we're talking about this, like this is something that like 18 Productions and distribution companies have to consider. You know, they have to think about this. And also you got to think about theater chains. If they show something like this, are they going to have people who are like just fervently against this picketing outside their theater? And is that good or bad for business? For The Exorcist, it was good. It made people way more interested in checking out this movie, you know, but for a movie like Schrader's Hardcore, is that good? I understand if they were concerned. That's all I'll say, right? But from an artist perspective, fuck those people. Like, Schrader should be able to make whatever he wants as far as I'm concerned. But again, I digress. So the company, 18 Productions, I mean, worked closely with Schrader to develop a marketing strategy that would highlight the film's serious, you know, exploration of complex themes while also acknowledging its controversial content. And this approach aimed to attract both cinephiles interested in thought-provoking, boundary-pushing cinema and audiences drawn to the film's sensational aspects, kind of the exploitation aspect of this film. And the balance was delicate, but 18 Productions' understanding of the film's potential audience helped ensure that Hardcore received the attention it needed to succeed in a marketplace in 1979, like a film marketplace. But we'll cross the distribution bridge when we get there. First, let's talk more about production. A key aspect of Schrader's approach to hardcore was his insistence on shooting in real locations, as he believed that the film's emotional and narrative weight would only be enhanced by a gritty, authentic atmosphere. Much of the film was shot in LA and San Francisco, two cities with well-known ties to the adult film industry, and Schrader and his team sought out actual porn theaters, strip clubs, and other seedy establishments that reflected the grim reality of the world into which Jake Van Dorn descended. These locations were essential to making the film feel true to life, and they presented significant logistical and safety challenges. Shooting in these environments required a delicate balance between maintaining the film's artistic vision and ensuring the safety and comfort of the cast and crew. Porn theaters and adult film sets were not typically shooting locations for mainstream films in the 1970s, and securing permits, you know, to film in such places was no small feat. And let me clarify, I'm not saying that the following information about securing permits is exactly what happened to Schrader, but I just want you to consider this more generally. By granting permits to films trying to film in such locations like porn theaters and strip clubs, authorities risked appearing complicit in promoting these areas, even if the film itself was critical of the industry. Now, at the time, public sensibilities regarding pornography and the adult entertainment industry were, you know, generally conservative, and many municipalities enacted strict zoning laws governing where adult theaters and businesses could operate, like literally just exist, right? So authorities would likely hesitate to issue permits for films that portrayed these environments due to, you know, concerns about public decency and the negative perception of having mainstream film productions, you know, in areas known for adult entertainment. And so cities had regulations governing the use of locations for adult entertainment, and these could vary greatly between municipalities. And Schrader's film, with its explicit content and themes of moral degradation, would have been seen as problematic in this regard, and authorities might not have wanted to risk public outrage or legal issues by allowing the film to shoot in these locations. And so many of the areas where porn theaters and strip clubs were located, you know, unfortunately, we find them in what are largely considered undesirable or dangerous locations with higher crime rates and poorer infrastructure. Because, of course, the things that we see as degrading society get thrown into the high crime rate and poorer infrastructure part of the city. But I digress. I'll get off my soapbox now. These neighborhoods were not welcoming to outside media or productions, especially ones that might shine a spotlight on their activities. Because again, if not everything's above board in this area, they don't want more lights shining on their underboardness or whatever. Anyways, so residents and business owners could have resisted filming in their area. This very well could have happened. I'm not saying all of this happened to Schrader, but my brain starts running with like what could have happened, you know? So yeah, they could have resisted filming in their area, further complicating the permit process. And authorities may have feared that filming in such areas could stir up unwanted attention or disrupt, you know, the local economy. Film productions often require special insurance, too, for cast and crew safety, which would have been more difficult to secure in these high-risk environments. And insurers may have been hesitant to cover a production in these areas, which could have added additional hurdles to obtaining necessary permits. Business owners running adult theaters and other establishments may have been wary of allowing a mainstream production to film on their premises for fear that it would draw unwanted attention from authorities or result in further legal action against these businesses. And these owners may have had informal agreements with law enforcement that kept them operating under the radar, and a film like Hardcore could have jeopardized that. So all that to say, it was a very complex issue. Now, additionally, the actors and crew had to be willing to work in environments that were at times uncomfortable or even dangerous, particularly in the neighborhoods surrounding these establishments. So despite these challenges, Schrader pushed forward, believing that the realism of the locations would heighten the film's impact and ensure that Hardcore resonated with audience on a visceral level. Now, given the nature of the film's content, the production of Hardcore was often fraught with tension. Schrader had to navigate the balance between pushing the envelope with the film's explicit subject matter and ensuring that the tone remained serious rather than exploitative. This required constant communication between Schrader and his cast, particularly Scott and actress Susan Hubley, who played Nikki, a porn actress and ally to Van Dorn. And Susan Hubley's role as Nikki was pivotal, just a critical addition, as she represented the world that Van Dorn detested, yet needed in order to find his daughter. And Schrader worked closely with Hubley to ensure that her character was more than just a caricature of the porn industry, but rather Nikki was a woman with her own motivations and struggles. And Schrader wanted to ensure that, you know, her portrayal was grounded in emotional depth. So Hubley, like Scott, brought a seriousness to the role that allowed Schrader to explore the moral ambiguities of the story without falling into sensationalism. Now, despite the difficulties, Schrader fostered a collaborative atmosphere on set. He valued the input of his characters and actors, understanding that their contributions would shape the final product. And the trust Schrader built with his cast, particularly Scott and Hubley, was instrumental in overcoming the challenges of the production and ensuring that the performances remained authentic to the film's thematic core. And all this was brought to life by cinematographer Michael Chapman. Chapman, who had previously worked with Schrader on Taxi Driver, brought a visual style to Hardcore that mirrored the descent of Van Dorn into the darker aspects of society. The lighting and camera work were deliberately stark, using a mix of neon-lit urban landscapes and shadowy interiors to evoke the disorientation and degradation of Van Dorn and that which he experienced. So Chapman's cinematography played a significant role in creating the film's somber and gritty tone. It enhanced the emotional impact of the narrative, I would argue. The film's visual style was also notable for its contrasts, juxtaposing the sterile, structured world of Van Dorn's Calvinist home, you know, the home life in Grand Rapids and all that in the Midwest, with the chaotic and morally ambiguous environments of the porn theaters and adult film sets where he explored in L.A. and San Francisco. So Schrader and Chapman worked together to ensure that the visuals reflected the film's thematic exploration of moral decay and redemption. Chapman is notable also, just a side note here, Chapman is notable as a notable figure in Hollywood. He worked on such projects as Hal Ashby's The Last Detail, which was actually Chapman's first film as a cinematographer. He did Taxi Driver, of course, Raging Bull, The Lost Boys, and The Fugitive, just to name a handful. But despite these hardships, Schrader was not done yet. He had to tackle the biggest beast of them all, post-production and Columbia Pictures. The editing was handled by Tom Rolfe, a seasoned editor best known for his work on Taxi Driver. See, now, there's that name again. I'm telling you. I can't wait to do a Taxi Driver episode, but Rolfe's expertise in crafting intense character-driven narratives made him a perfect choice for Hardcore, as the film required careful pacing to build tension and focus on the psychological descent of the protagonist, Jake Van Dorn. Schrader's vision for the film was one of emotional intensity, where the audience would be drawn deeper into Van Dorn's disturbing journey through the underground world of pornography. And Rolfe's editing played a crucial role in this, as he carefully balanced the narrative's pacing, ensuring that the moments of high tension and emotional turmoil were given space to resonate. His work helped maintain the film's momentum without overwhelming the audience with its darker themes, keeping the psychological and emotional struggles at the forefront while subtly building toward the film's climax. The distribution of Hardcore, however, what a story, was managed by Columbia Pictures, the studio that had previously distributed You guessed it, folks. Taxi Driver. Now, in June 1978, a guy named Daniel Melnick became the head of Columbia. And I'm going to put a pin in the name Dan Melnick. We'll come back to that here shortly. But Schrader's relationship with Columbia was shaped by his growing reputation as a filmmaker who could deliver not only artistically challenging films, but also those with commercial potential. So Taxi Driver had proven to both be a critical and financial success, and this track record gave Schrader the leverage when he was negotiating Hardcore. However, the content of Hardcore, which obviously dealt explicitly with the pornography industry and featured, disturbing scenes of sexual exploitation, posed significant challenges for the studio. Columbia was aware that the film could stir controversy. What am I, Sean Connery? But that it could stir controversy. Okay, that's a no-brainer. But it could potentially alienate mainstream audiences. Now, at the same time, though, the studio recognized Schrader's ability to create films that pushed boundaries and generated discussion, something that could work in the film's favor and if marketed correctly. So the explicit content also required special consideration when it came to securing an appropriate rating from the Motion Picture Association of America. That's right, folks, the MPAA. I talked about this in the last episode. So at this time, films with explicit sexual content risked receiving an X rating. This was the doom rating. This was the you didn't want this. It would severely limit the commercial distribution that a film could have. So Schrader and Columbia had to work together to ensure that the film maintained its gritty and controversial edge without crossing into territory that would make it unmarketable. And in the end, Hardcore received an R rating, allowing it to reach wider audiences, albeit with a warning about its mature content. But at what cost? Well, Columbia Pictures had to position the film as a serious psychological thriller rather than exploitative fare, despite its subject matter. And the studio sought to emphasize George C. Scott's performance and Schrader's reputation as a respected filmmaker rather than focusing on the film's explicit themes. However, the challenge was to market Hardcore in a way that would draw in audiences curious about the film's, controversial nature without alienating more conservative viewers. And Columbia was confident that Hardcore could find an audience, especially among those drawn to darker, more complex stories. And what came next is heartbreaking for a creator like myself. But instead of me telling you, here's Paul Schrader in an interview for A Decade Under the Influence, a 2003 documentary about the new Hollywood movement.
It's the only film that I've ever changed the ending on under studio pressure. And I've never done it since. I'm the only one to blame. I did it. It totally fucked the movie. The ending is completely bogus. And Dan Melnick, told me I had to change the ending, and I did.
What was the ending originally?
This guy gets involved in the world of pornography trying to find his daughter. He completely soils himself in terms of who he is by contact with that world. And then he finds out his daughter has been killed in a car accident unrelated to pornography. And he has to go back home. So that, in fact, he never finds his daughter. The original ending was sort of more like Chinatown, which is, forget it, it's Chinatown. Go home, pretend this didn't happen. But how do you pretend it doesn't happen? I thought that was a much more interesting film. But I was afraid that Blue Collar hadn't come out yet. I was afraid I would never direct again, and I did that thing. But I did swear I would never do it again, even if it meant walking off.
Now, although I understand that if this were my baby, this project, I'd be fucking pissed too. So, Paul, I see you, brother. However, I don't think the ending ruins the movie. He makes it out like it's completely bogus. But again, from his perspective, I could see why he'd be pissed. I don't think the ending is horrible. I'm not going to fully ruin it right now for anybody. So don't worry. Go check the movie out. That said, critically, Hardcore was met with a wide range of reactions, honestly. Some critics admired the film for its unflinching portrayal of a father's descent into the seedy underworld in search of his daughter, praising both Schrader's writing and Scott's powerful performance. They viewed the film as a dark, compelling exploration of moral conflict, redemption, and despair. Roger Ebert was a notable supporter of the film, giving it a 4 out of 4 star review, but also agreed that although the ending could be better, it didn't ruin the movie. Okay, so I see you, Roger. However, other critics were less enthusiastic, finding the film exploitative and overly focused on its controversial subject matter. The explicit depictions of the porn industry, coupled with the uncomfortable subject matter, alienated some audiences who really were not prepared for the intensity of the material. From the general audience perspective, the film did not achieve the same level of cultural resonance as Taxi Driver, which is very easy to say, I guess, though it did attract attention for its daring themes and powerful performances. In later years, Hardcore would gain a small but dedicated following of fans who appreciated its uncompromising look at the darker side of human nature. But one might even say Hardcore has even developed something of a cult following these days, particularly among fans of Paul Schrader's work. And I guess I'm a cult member because I'm a big fan. The film's willingness to tackle controversial themes combined with its stark visual style and George C. Scott's intense performance has kept it relevant, really, in discussions of films that explore the darker aspects of that human experience. While it may not have been a runaway success upon release, Hardcore has earned a place as one of Schrader's most provocative and challenging films, continuing to resonate with audiences drawn to morally complex narratives. So what more is there to say about Hardcore? I've sat here and talked for 45 damn minutes about this movie. Well, when I come back, I'm going to bring Matthew Soucy with me to discuss the experience of just watching the movie and our thoughts on the movie personally. Just two dudes talking movies. We'll be right back. As we know, Paul Schrader is a lifetime member of Bummerville.
Oh, big time. He's got a bare one-bedroom apartment in downtown Bummersville. Boy, does he ever.
This is what I love about this guy. And I've said this already on the episode, but I'll tell you that I never knew I was as big a Paul Schrader fan as I am now. I always knew that I loved a lot of the movies that he wrote. The 4 movies he did with Scorsese, Rolling Thunder, you know, The Yakuza, which you've mentioned to me off
also known as The Yakuza.
Yeah, The Yakuza. Yeah.
Sorry, so, pull up the trailer. You know what? Let's pull the whole thing off. It's okay.
It's who is it? Robert Mitchum, if I remember correctly.
That's right. We should do that song. I say Yakuza. You say Yakuza. Yakuza. Yeah, but I, by the way, sorry. 70s Robert Mitchum is I think an underrated era in film. So, really? If you from Ryan's Daughter, probably until The Amsterdam Kill or maybe I have to look, but he had
another Philip Marlowe, didn't he?
Yeah, he did Farewell, My Lovely, The Big Sleep, yeah. Friends of Eddie Coyle, The Amsterdam Kill. This
Friends
film
of Eddie Coyle's good.
Yeah, so don't the Roger Ebert's favorite movie star was Robert Mitchum, and I get it, man. I mean, even long before Liam Neeson got old and whooped ass, it was Robert Mitchum.
You know what's funny too? Now that we're on a tangent with Robert Mitchum, right off the bat, too, we nailed this. But anyway, with Robert Mitchum, the funny thing is every time I watch a trailer for his 70s movies, because I admittedly have not seen enough of them. I've seen a few. But every time there is a woman clearly 30 years younger than him, that's the love interest.
And your point is... we're terrible. Guys run Hollywood.
It's super funny. No, but it's funny. Well, because it's that feeling of like... This actor's trying, it feels like he's trying to be so young rather than the other way around of like, oh, he's being gross. But no, I'm not even talking about that. It's like, it's like they're trying to push him so much as being like this younger guy. It's like, dude, embrace it. You're actually a cool, badass old dude. Like, what's happening?
He is. It's the other people around him that's trying to. So he doesn't care. He still goes to the bars and does what he wants, and people will either follow him or they wouldn't. So,
well, we're talking about Paul Schrader.
I'm curious. I'm sorry, I'm gonna interrupt you. In what order did you watch these four films? Did you watch them in chronological
order? Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay. I did not.
I watched Hardcore. I didn't. Let me clarify this. I've been dying to see American Gigolo for years, but it's not on Criterion Channel. And I was trying to stick to these in case they got taken off Criterion Channel.
Understood.
So I stuck to the movies that were on there first. I'm going to rewatch First Reformed and some of the newer ones that are good. I'll watch American Gigolo as well, perhaps before this episode actually drops. But for this one, I watched Hardcore first, Cat People, Mishima, and then Light Sleeper. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Because I did not. I saw your post about Mishima and started with it. And then Cat People, because I needed something lighter. Then Light Sleeper, because I hadn't seen it in a long ass. I bought Hardcore last year. So I you know, it was the one I had seen most recently.
Gotcha.
And I thought, I don't need that big of a brush up on Hardcore. But okay, cool. I was just curious.
No worries. Yeah, because that's actually the one we're starting with here. Hardcore from 1979. And I had seen this one before. I had actually not seen any of the other three prior to this. Paul Schrader was a rather large blind spot for me as his director stuff. Because I had seen Hardcore. I had seen Autofocus. I had seen First Reform, The Card Counter. It's like random movies of his. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But Hardcore, I always really loved. And I think part of it, too, is knowing his background with the Calvinist church and also like my background with like traditional Protestant Christianity. You know what I mean? When I saw Hardcore the first time, I just like related to it a lot differently. Not related in, I don't know how to say that. It was different because I grew up in a church that believed that everything that George C. Scott's character does in the latter half of the movie is a bad thing. I know it is, but my point is I saw the world closer through George C. Scott at the beginning of the movie,
so I could
feel the weight of like, oh, he's around sex workers. Oh, wait, yep. Oh my God, he's, you know, like. I was so much more sheltered when I saw this the first time. Watching it this time was so different because I was able to almost entirely detach from the personal view and see it as a film. You get what I'm saying?
I do. I was raised a smart-ass Catholic, and my connection with Schrader. So my dad recorded Taxi Driver. It was one of the first things we ever recorded off television. So we had a TV copy of Taxi Driver for a while, nice. Partly because my dad did a 6-month residency in New York City while Taxi Driver was being filmed. So this was 1975. And the hotel that he stayed at was a place called the Hotel Alcott on West 72nd Street. And I know that because there's a scene in Taxi Driver where the cab pulls up to the Hotel Alcott at the beginning of the film. So I got to see this at way too young an age. And I think as I have written on, one of our colleagues, I thought Taxi Driver was a horror film. It's truly a horror, forget killer sharks, forget guys in ski masks or, you know, William Shatner mask. Travis Bickle is sitting next to you talking your ear off at a bar right now. He is clapping outside the White House on January 6th. You know, I saw a 20th anniversary of Taxi Driver at the Music Box Theater in Chicago. It was a full house, shocking, mostly guys. And they applauded when you saw Travis with his mohawk for the first time. That's truly terrifying.
Yeah.
That being said, I saw Hardcore when it was on cable, when I was old enough to stay at home by myself and both my parents were gone, and I knew it was, and I had already seen Blue Collar and loved Blue Collar. And man, I had to watch a cartoon first after watching it, and then I took a shower. Just this eye-opening of, oh my God, yeah, and they do this, and oh, now they take credit cards? I mean, yikes. I've jokingly said that, you know, if you need a story about a white guy going down a downward spiral, Paul Schrader's your man. That's, well, we'll find out with Mishima. That's not entirely true. You could be any race, creed, color, religion, and go down a downward spiral in his films. But yeah, I think George C. Scott was amazing in this. I want to do a series of George C. Scott films in the 70s for the film Yep sometime soon. But you know, he's a force in this, and I think it still holds up. It's terrifying.
Oh my God, it holds up. And I remember the first time I watched it, because I love this movie. I remember the first time that I saw it, I saw a not great restoration of, like, it, or I wouldn't even call it a restoration. It just looked bad. I mean, it was a DVD, but it was like one of those really old DVDs where they probably just took the VHS and put it on DVD. Real bad. So it was like, I never thought of this movie as looking cool. I just always thought, like, oh man, the story is really interesting and this character's cool, but like, or interesting, I guess would be a better word. But watching the one on Criterion that is this full restoration, dude, the lighting in this movie rules.
Yeah.
So colorful. When he goes into some of these joints that are like just bathed in red light, it just reminds me of, like, there's such a vision and style behind this that when you watch a movie by someone like Paul Schrader or any of the other people we've talked about, including someone like a Scorsese or something, like, when you watch that versus someone just making another Marvel movie or something, no shade, but reality.
No shade.
Like, there's a clear distinction between, like, this person knows the medium of film, right? And, like, they understand cinematic language versus that someone made a story that makes sense. You know what I'm saying? And it's like this movie, I was like, damn, all the way back in 1979, he already got it. And he started watching movies when he was 17.
Yeah, because of his upbringing. The other part I love about Schrader, there are certain people that will dismiss critics as saying, well, they're frustrated artists. Well, Paul Schrader wrote film reviews for magazines. So did Peter Bogdanovich. So did another of future filmmakers. And so I've always appreciated that. So because as we were talking, I do theater from time to time. So you can have your cake and eat it too if you do it right. So there.
Yeah.
The other thing I was thinking about with watching this, especially that the last half hour of the film, and you talk about the Red Room, where you could perform sex acts and develop pictures at the same time. I think that film ran so American Gigolo could fly, because that started what I called Schrader's glossy period with American Gigolo, Cat People, and Mishima, where the colors and the lighting are really impressive and kind of a period of its times. I know we'll get into Mishima later, but those scenes in those rooms and the fact that you have a chase, it almost turns into Peckinpah because he uses slow motion with the chase scene of busting through these fake walls, themed rooms. And
this does one of the funniest things I think a lot of movies from this era, before now everything is like breakable and it splits apart so everything looks perfect and nowadays, right? But back then there's a point where George C. Scott breaks through that last wall and he just completely beefs it over this couch.
He's the Shockmaster. It's the Shockmaster intro.
If you don't know what the Shockmaster
intro is, look it up,
folks. Look it up on YouTube. It's a wrestling thing and it's the fucking funniest thing I've ever seen. But so let's go back to this real quick. So obviously, like, Paul Schrader, awesome. We're big fans. I can't wait to see American Gigolo. It's the one I've wanted to see the most. That and Mishima for years. And I'm really glad that I finally got around to all these. The next movie I plan to watch, which I'll watch tonight or tomorrow or something, I'll probably see American Gigolo. But George C. Scott, you talked about. He is one of those people that commands a screen.
Oh yeah,
that's I know that's like an understatement, but I mean like I don't know how else I want to word that. You know, he knows how to command a screen. He knows how to sell emotions, and he's also this weird bridge between like old and new Hollywood.
You know what I'm saying? Oh yeah, he swung for the fences. I mean, he started out obviously in theater, and he continued to do theater a lot, most of his acting career. But yeah, he came up from the old school, and but he also had a reputation of being huge. He had a reputation of being an alcoholic. He had a reputation of being difficult to work with. So you kind of took your chances with him, but when he delivered, he absolutely delivered. I know he was, of course, everyone's favorite General Buck Turkington in Dr. Strangelove. And, you know, he got frustrated because he wanted the more serious cuts in his performance, and Kubrick cut the silliest ones, which kind of made the performance. I mean, he won. I love the fact that he won an Oscar for Patton, turned it down, and then we thought, well, he's banned from the Academy Awards. And then the next year got nominated for The Hospital, which is an underappreciated dark comedy from 1971. By the time he gets to Hardcore, I know he didn't get along with Schrader, but man, the scene, you think he's going to rip the chairs out of the seats. When I first started film sociology, back when we used to do, when I had a producer and we had sound clips for good responses to good films and bad films, yeah. One of them was him screaming, "Turn it off."
Yeah.
So, oh,
that's so good, actually.
Yeah.
That's so good because it's funny because it's moments like that, actually. I'm glad you pinpointed that, because when I was talking about him at just a minute ago, I was thinking of that scene.
Yeah. And it's also a Mystery Science Theater riff, which I'm happy to say, you know, if anything else in pop culture. And I think if you say Hardcore, people will know that scene. They kind of, you know, sort of recognize that scene or that moment.
Yeah, it's I think it is a perfect blend of old and new Hollywood, like I was saying. And let me tell you why. I think his performance there, which is not bad by any means, he's very good. I don't want it to come off that way. But whenever he's screaming, "Turn it off," there is this almost old Hollywood acting vibe to just that moment.
Yep.
But whenever you think of the Schrader context of him literally not being forced, but being sat in a seat and then shown a porn film starring his
daughter
who he assumes was kidnapped, like,
and it's got like two guys on
so
her.
Fucked up, like that's like that is new Hollywood to the max, like that you couldn't even come close to that before. So it's so interesting to see like this kind of, I don't want to call it this because it sounds bad, but like there are like remnants of old Hollywood in it, bathed in this new Hollywood context. And I personally love that, but I could see maybe some younger viewers or people less familiar with that maybe not being as impressed with George C. Scott. I think he's fucking great in this
movie. Yeah, he is. There, I remember, and it's funny, I rediscovered it about a year ago. My freshman year at Ball State, the Ball State University, I saw on some dude's front door, he put a ballot box, and it was a shoebox with a hole in it. And the article, which I later found out was from National Lampoon, so you could probably find it on the internet later, but it said, "Who's angrier, George C. Scott or Kirk Douglas?" And it has, you know, two really angry looking pictures of the two of them and some of their famous lines of rage. And "Turn It Off" is one of those on Mr. Scott's end. I think between with Dr. Strange and which proved he could do comedy, you know, he got an Oscar for Patton. He's got a great chew out in The Hospital, which I absolutely loved. The strangest thing is the first film of his I ever saw in the theater was Islands in the Stream, which is based on an Ernest Hemingway short story. It reteams him with the director of Patton, and he's playing not Ernest Hemingway, But it was a soft performance. It's a kind of a gentle performance because he reunites with his three sons, and then there's this whole it's very episodic about this artist living in the Caribbean who's supposed to be, but it's not Ernest Hemingway, even though he looks a lot like Ernest Hemingway. it was one of the softer performances, and I don't mean that it's not a critique. That's just it's kind of a nurturing father figure. And then 2 years later, he does Hardcore.
Yeah. I mean, he has like a crazy list of movies. And even if you don't know most of them, like just looking at them, just like the stuff he was involved in, even if he didn't have a huge role, and in some cases he did, but just being in movies like Anatomy of a Murder or The Hustler.
Love Anatomy of a Murder. The Hustler. Yeah.
Dr. Strangelove, one of my favorite Kubricks, and everyone knows Kubrick is my favorite personally. But like you already said, Patton is
the Bible. He was in that. He did a thing called Movie with Stanley Donen, which was a double feature in
right
in
before Hardcore, actually. But
Exorcist 3 and
Changeling, which is largely known as a bit of one of the classics of the era.
Even near the end of his career, he worked with Jack Lemmon for two cable movies, remakes of 12 Angry Men and Inherit the Wind, and they're both really good. Really good.
I've wanted to watch the 12 Angry Men actually, but I haven't seen that yet. So we already know George C. Scott's great in this. I do want to talk about a little bit of the other cast here, namely. Obviously, we get to see Dick Sargent out of the Bewitched context. So that's fun.
I'm so glad he got to have a dramatic performance in his career.
Yeah, yeah. And he plays the square kind of in this movie, which is perfect, actually. Yes. So I actually really like him in this. But
also, want to give a shout out to Peter Boyle, who was the wizard in Scorsese's Taxi Driver, and it's almost like a yang to his yang of the wizard. While the wizard was. He plays a cab driver who gives some advice to Travis Bickle and is trying to be supportive, but what does he know? He's just a cabbie. Yeah. And he's kind of the flip of this as a very cynical private eye who is doing his job. Maybe not when George C. Scott sees him in his apartment with a young girl and not to the attitude that George C. Scott is paying for. But he is this weird kind of guardian angel hovering over this Calvinist trying to find his daughter in the sleaze of San Diego and Los Angeles.
Yeah. I mean, I like Peter Boyle in a lot, like most things I feel like. So I really love him, but in this, he plays such an interesting character, and it's funny because the perspective of the movie really does kind of fall into George C. Scott's character's Jake Van Dorn. And so in Jake's perspective, the lens in which we kind of see it early on is through Jake's perspective. So Peter Boyle's character, Andy Mast, obviously looks like a fuck up. But as the movie goes on, you start to realize that he's just different than Jake. Like he's not like you just said, he's not doing his job poorly. It's just he's not maybe working 24 hours a day on this stupid shit that Jake wants him to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
then Jake starts dropping names to Andy, that Andy starts getting concerned about, like, why do you even know the name of this person? You see him start to take it a bit more seriously, starts to really investigate things. I just think the dynamic of Andy Mast and the way Peter Boyle pulls it off, I think, is great.
Well, and their first meeting together, the first profanity that he drops, and George C. Scott's character tries to correct him, and then he tries to counter-correct, kind of you get what you pay for, and he counter-corrects with, well, then I'll take my money elsewhere. Also the fact that another character in this film is Grand Rapids, Michigan, which, as somebody who grew up in Flint, I was like, wow, how come Grand Rapids gets to be in the movie? The other thing is, filmgoers, take your time with this picture because the first 15 minutes of it is in George C. Scott's world. We're there for a reason. We sit through a dinner and church and work, and then we get, like in Sid Field's, the plot's supposed to happen at 10 minutes. It really happens about 15. And soon we get this kind of Odyssey-like journey for George C. Scott's character.
I'm glad you brought that up because I want to come back to Cecin Hubley here in a second, who plays Nicky. But I'll come back to that because I want to go with what you're talking about now. That's really important. And I want to draw a parallel to another movie. And then I want to also bring something Schrader said in that I've probably mentioned earlier in the episode already. But with Jake Van Dorn, I like to think of the beginning of this movie, which is like, you know, for the first, what, half an hour or so, we're seeing all the things that you just said, Matt. But like, I think of a movie like The Deer Hunter. And it's like 3 hours long. And the first hour of that movie, I think when I first watched it, I just remember thinking, God damn, like nothing is happening in this movie. What is going on? And then you get to the center part, right, where you have all of these people in war and then they get taken by the Vietnamese and all this. And they do the Russian roulette thing. And it's intense as fuck. And then they go back and the third hour is basically the first hour again. With the context and the weight and the PTSD and trauma of war on it, which retroactively makes the first hour unbelievable to me, but like it feels kind of boring at first. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, what we've learned is when you start your film with a wedding, to quote my kid watching Hamlet the first time, this isn't going to end good. Yeah. I present to you The Deer Hunter, The Godfather, and Breaking the Waves.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, when you start with a wedding, it's Bummersville Presbyterian from here. You reminded me of when I was in college. There was a bunch of kids that lived on my floor who had never seen The Exorcist, and I brought The Exorcist over. Now, this is late 80s, gang, late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, if you remember, there's 45 minutes before any really weird stuff starts to kick in. And unfortunately, my classmates who had been raised on slasher movies where there's bloodshed within 5 to 10 minutes. And I kept telling them, I said, stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. And once the pea soup comes, you know, strap on and here we go. So, but yet it takes some time before we get there. So,
yeah.
So yeah, 15 minutes in Grand Rapids, you could do a lot worse.
Well, actually, but here's the thing though. I think this movie, like Paul Schrader talks about hardcore differently. He talks about it as like the first hour, you're actually able to see this person who seems like a relatively innocent person. He's a God-fearing man. He's from the Midwest. He's out of his element. And you spend time with him and you can start to empathize for him. He's trying to find his daughter. She's lost in this place. For all we know, she's been kidnapped. He has to hire these people and they're not doing the job the way he wants. I mean, there's something potentially empathetic about it, right? And then he starts doing things that start to cause cognitive dissonance in us, right? He starts to do things where we now empathize for this character, but he's doing things that we may not see as something that we would support or something. There's even a point where I'm pretty sure he hits Cecin Hubley's character, Nikki, and he puts his hand around her throat, and you're like, damn.
He does.
To the first 15 minutes. He does not seem like that kind of guy, you know?
And that's the thing with this is, so yeah, first we get the fish out of water, and we get the scene, the square churchgoer going into the red room and being told about, you know, what do you want for this and how much you want for that. And he's just trying to get information. So there's that aspect of it. The other thing with this film is he is not enjoying this. This isn't like Cruising or others where, you know, where you go undercover and you become so immersed in it that it starts to become a part of you. He wants nothing to do with this. We also find out as time goes on, it's like, he's not the greatest guy. Because first, we assume that his wife is dead. He even says to Cecin Hubley, my wife is dead. Nah, your wife left you. And not to give away the ending on this, but the first thing his daughter says to him when they connect is kind of a gut punch. And, you know, there's a redemption story, but not quite what you think. And I will just kind of be vague.
Yeah, no.
I think the moment as I was taking in my notes, I forgot that the first time he goes undercover to meet with the porn.
Yeah.
It's about as smooth as it gets. I mean, he's, you know, he is squarely dressed in, these kind of brown suits. Well, hold on.
Because whenever he goes to see that dude, this is, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, his attempt at trying to fit in, where he clearly just went into a store and bought what was on a mannequin.
It is. But the fact that he had a business background, so he was able to go and sit at this guy's table, and he's a classic 70s that guy with the chains, and I remember him from Where the Buffalo Roam, among others. And they're able to talk shop a little bit, and it got him on the lot, which gets him to meet Susan Hubley's character. I, of course, laughed my ass off with the tie-dye shirt, the wig, and the mustache when he's doing the audition scenes, where I'm like, you have no idea what you're doing. And then the other shirts, the kind of funky, flammable polyester shirts that you could strike a match on. You know, it gets slightly better, but that one moment where, you know, he's has a business meeting is about as confident as I think he gets in this film.
Yeah.
And because later he loses it on Susan Hubley. She's an actress, a sex worker, and starts to become substitute daughter figure when she helps him because she's paying him to help find his daughter. I love the scenes of spirituality.
Yeah.
That the two of them have.
Well, let me go there real quick, because that was where I wanted to go next. You just led me right to it. One of my favorite scenes, actually, although it feels, in retrospect, I think it feels a little forced, but I love it so much.
That's Schrader, though.
It's great. Which is there? I forget. Are they in an airport or something? They're sitting somewhere, but they're talking.
Talks about tulips.
They're talking to one another, and Susan Hubley's character Nikki just can't wrap her brain around God, because she is like a Venetian, as she calls herself, you know, and Jake is trying to explain to her why he believes what he does and why it makes sense. And this is another thing where growing up in the church and growing up in a church that has very, very similar logic to Jake, though I did not grow up in a church that believed in predestination. They believed in free will, but George C. Scott's character, Jake, they believe in predestination. He breaks down Tulip, which I don't have in front of me, or I would, but it's the kind of tenets of this first Reformed Calvinist church. He is talking about how the people that are going to go to heaven, you know, are the people, like, they're pre-chosen, which is the basis of predestination in that context. And Nikki's just like, wait. So you're saying, like, if I'm not chosen, I'm already screwed? And he's just like, basically. And she's like, why do I give a fuck? Like, you know, like, she's just like, I'll just be worse. Like, what is this? Like, where's the motivation here?
early in the film, when his daughter winds up missing and he is starting to, George Scott's character is starting to grow more distant, and there's a scene on the porch with him and Dick Sargent and the other old guys, and, you know, it's like, we haven't seen you in weeks, Jake.
Yeah.
And it's hard to understand the Lord's ways. He's testing you. And there's that thing of, by the way that it is worded, you know, God said, you know what your daughter needs? A slave of love experience.
Yeah.
That's, and I'm like, no, that, yeah, there's that thing of.
But that scene, you're spot on, because it sounds archaic and fucked up and Old Testament. And it's like they're talking, but George C. Scott's response to that, because Dick Sargent's character, Wes, who is his brother-in-law, I believe.
Yes.
Wes is like, you know, God's doing this for a reason. Like, he's testing you, and like, you have to like fight through it, and you have to test yourself. You have to move on. And George C. Scott's Jake says, would you? And that's all he says to him, just like a really brief spot. And Dick Sargent's character just like sits back, because he just kind of got owned. And that moment also almost softens you to Jake even more, because he's a square. But that's also the question when he says it. You're like, oh yeah, fuck yeah. What about you, idiot? Like, you know, like you, you know, you almost root for him in that moment. And then it goes all the way to the latter half, like maybe the last third of the movie or whatever. And they're in that airport, and now he's being the freaking square. You know what I mean?
And the fact that Sargent's character. Well, and you know, when Sargent finds Jake, George C. Scott's character, in the hotel and is told to go away, then he goes behind his back to Peter Boyle's character. All this, and then you realize that's his sister. Well, that's his brother-in-law, the wife who left him, not the one who died.
Yeah.
So that adds even more shade, but that adds more character and depth to Sargent's character. So way to go, Dick Sargent.
Yeah, dude. Actually, full transparency, I didn't think of that. Like, that's actually really awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't thinking of Dick Sargent's Wes when you find out about the wife. So that's actually great. I love that. But it's that kind of stuff. Like, what Schrader does is, like, some people might consider these kind of slow burn, just like everyman dramas or whatever. And you have, like, the classic saying of God's Lonely Man. And he makes all these characters that are in some way either entrenched in religion or entrenched in an ideology or doctrine of some kind. And, you know, whether it's, I mean, we'll get to Light Sleeper and Mishima and all, I mean, all of them. Now, Cat People's a little different. So it's autofocus because he didn't write that. But, but, you know, like all of these movies like this and what, like even something like Rolling Thunder. I mean, you have Hook Hand. You know
what I'm saying? Wow. Hook Hand. Okay, Peter Pan.
Yeah.
One of these days, a great rain will wash the scum off the streets.
No, but anyways, So I agree with you. I love, like, watching Hardcore first. I was just like, man, already knowing, and I'd already written, like, the beginning of the episode for Schrader, and thinking about the first Reformed, like, Calvinist background he has stands out like crazy.
Yeah. The other thing is, after he slaps Season Hubley, he kisses her on the forehead and says, "I won't forget you."
Yeah.
And sure enough, and then there's a scene with Hubley and Boyle where he says, as soon as he finds his kid, you're out of the picture. And not giving away stuff. It's not a complete happy ending. Well, happy by Paul Schrader standards. Which adds some more of the, this is just a guy. He's just a normal human being.
Yeah.
Or as I wrote in my notes, out of season.
There's something about like 70s
antiheroes
and the look of them and the just the way things even sound. This movie in particular, just I love one of my favorite things about film history. And we'll start to close on Hardcore here. But one of my favorite things about film history is like being able to watch movies from an era and feel like I'm getting something that at the very least feels authentic, whether it is. And whenever he's walking around the city, this place feels lit. I mean, it is lived in, but you know what I mean? Like, it feels lived in. It feels like a universe that exists. It feels as grimy as he sees it, you know, and it feels like there is a whole world outside of this. But because he's an outsider, we don't even know the half of it. Of all that's out here, right? And he uncovers some of those things as you go forward, but this movie is, I just love it.
I'm looking at my notes. I also forget the scene where they're shooting the porn film. This is where we meet the producer and his gold chains, and Boyle shows up and watches, and the producer leans over and goes, "Kid's a UCLA student." So, because
what's that dude's name? Hold on, I gotta find him.
I forget his name, but that, you know, he's a classic that guy. If you need somebody to play kind of skeezy businessman, I bring that up because shameless plug. If you read the film yap from last week, you can see my write up on Caligula, the ultimate cut, and part of it is where I talked about. When porno chic happened in the early 70s, when Deep Throat actually got a crossover audience, and then you had films like Beyond the Green Door, Devil and Miss Jones, the Emmanuel film series, where it's kind of softcore. So there's always been talk about trying to make legitimate porno films in autofocus. You know, Bob Crane, played by Greg Kinnear, and Not that John Carpenter, played by Willem Dafoe, are talking about, oh, we got to get a studio movie. We'll make a skin flick. And they even name drop Stella Stevens would be interested. And so there's always been that kind of talk. Burt Reynolds in Boogie Nights wants to make a legitimate studio pornography film. So all of that. So I just made me laugh even harder when this producer says, the director went to UCLA. like you're making The Seventh Seal or something. So.
Yeah. I love that. Anything else on Hardcore?
If you've seen 8mm and you haven't seen Hardcore, you really should correct that. Really correct that, because it's like saying Mean Girls is the offshoot of Heathers. I think this is a far, far better version of that story told by a much better director and a much better performance. But that's just me. I'm a 70s guy. So anyway, that's, yeah, if you want a trip to the seedy side of Bummerville, it's hardcore.
All right, folks, that is our episode. Today we talked quite a bit about hardcore. I hope this was fun for you to learn a lot of the history and cool things going on in the 70s. We talked about the pre-production, the production, post-production, the reception, the cult following. We talked about George C. Scott and Schrader and all the things. I even brought in beliefs, attitudes, and values to this damn thing. What the hell? But I had a great time. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Mishima Life in 4 chapters. I'll do a very similar breakdown of that. Matthew Soucy will come back to chat about that movie with me. And I will say, if you're interested in going to the theater this week, new in theaters this week, Beetlejuice on Friday, folks. Sequel to the old Beetlejuice masterpiece, as I would call it. But hey, that's all I have for you. Tune in next week for Mishima Life in 4 chapters. I'm looking forward to sharing more with you as the weeks come. And for now, good night, good luck, and take it easy.